Blog Talk Radio.
This is Renegade Broadcasting.
Welcome to the Blitzkrieg broadcast. It is November 11th, 2013. Yes, 11-11. Thank you so much for tuning in tonight. This is Renegade Broadcasting. And you can go join the chat room over at renegadebroadcasting.com and also be sure to check out all of the other great shows on this network. Tonight, I have a guest for you for 1 hour. We're going to be speaking with Mark Weber, so it should be a fascinating discussion. Mark is the director of the Institute for Historical Review. If you're not too familiar with this institute, well, you haven't really been looking into the Holocaust and revisionism enough, but it's a very important organization. And Mark has actually been the director since 1995. Before that, he became the editor-in-chief of the IHR's Journal of Historical Review in 1992. But he's apparently been associated with the organization since the 1980s. I met Mark out at the convention in California. Unfortunately, we weren't able to get him on film, but I was lucky enough to be able to actually present at the same conference as Mark Weber and a number of other great people. So Mark and myself and Mike, we all spoke, and it was really great to get back in touch with Mark and bring him on for this show tonight. There's much to discuss, and we only have an hour to do it. I have two calls already, which joined right as the show started, so I'm not sure which one of these is Mark, but I'll go with the first one and see if it's him. Mark, is that you?
Hello?
This is not Mark, is it?
No, this isn't Mark. I just have a question for him.
All right. Well, maybe towards the last few minutes of the broadcast, we'll be able to get you on for the question, but for now, I'm going to put you back on hold. Hi, Mark. Is that you?
Well, I hope so. Yes, I hear you fine.
All right, great. Welcome to the show. It's really great to have you here, Mark.
Well, it's a pleasure to be on, and I'm humbled by your very generous introduction. Thank you, and I was very pleased to meet you, as you mentioned, a few weeks ago, and to be with you this evening.
So, Mark, could you please tell us how you first became associated with the Institute for Historical Review? What drew you to the organization, and then also how you became director, and maybe just a brief overview of what the IHR is all about.
I guess I became associated because I knew personally the first director of the IHR, David McCalden. David McCalden was born in Northern Ireland. He lived in the United States. He's now passed away. But I had met him in England when I met members of what was then the most important nationalist organization in Britain, the National Front, at that time. And later he moved to the United States, and he came to California and was basically the founder of the IHR. He was the first director. He came up with this idea about the importance of emphasizing a more realistic and a greater awareness about history. And we met in Washington, D.C., where I was living at the time, or just outside of Washington, and he asked me to speak at the second conference of the newly founded IHR in 1980, which I did, and I began contributing to the IHR Journal, and sort of it grew from there, and that's how I got into all of this. It was through meeting somebody actually in England. I think, though, that our paths would have crossed because I grew up with a very strong interest in history from my parents and my background, and I because it was my own educational emphasis, both with a bachelor's degree and a master's degree, it was a sort of a natural fit to be with the IHR.
All right, so what is the main purpose of the IHR? You said you've been interested in history since a young age. There, we know that there's one historical event that is beyond question. In many countries in this world, even just questioning the official story can get you put in prison for many years. There's no other instance of a historical event that is beyond investigation. So could you please tell us about the IHR and some of the history of the organization?
Well, it's basically based on the thesis that George Orwell laid out in the famous novel 1984. He who controls the present controls the past, and he who controls the past controls the future. In other words, in every society, how we look at history, how we look at the narrative of the past, is, as Spengler once said, it's our form of political education. How we look at the past is how we really look at ourselves, how we define ourselves, and it's and an awareness of history, an awareness of the past is really very important, especially modern history. That is the history of the last several generations that lead to our own time. It's very, very important that to understand that how history is presented and how culture is as part of cultural life in any society is going to be determined by those who have power in society. And in our society, unfortunately, as I think every one of your listeners must be aware, the people who have power in our society are not interested in the best of what's best for the American people or for the world. They pursue their own interests, and that's reflected in the distortion of history and how it's presented. And what that does is reinforce in the minds of many people this idea that those who have power and the way we look at things today is inevitable. We can't do much to stop it. And we're trying very hard, and we have for years, to increase awareness about the past as it relates to important events here in the present and, to put it another way, to look at current events from a historical perspective. Now, I want to make a big point that if you take a look at our website, if you look at our the offerings of books and of tapes and discs, and not tapes anymore, but discs and so forth, and videos that we offer, you'll find that we cover a vast range of topics that I think are important and relevant today, not just World War II, not just the Holocaust, but a whole range of issues that are really, really relevant for Americans today. Right now, the whole world is, of course, and has been for some years, very focused on war and peace in the Middle East and what this costs for Americans. It costs us not just thousands of American lives, but hundreds of billions of dollars and, of course, the lives of many other people, and has a real impact on all of us. And an understanding of this complex turmoil and strife in the Middle East is really important, I think, for an understanding of the great conflicts that affect all of us.
I'd agree, Mark. You're taking a look at all of history, or at least certain events throughout history, and really applying a critical eye. But, as I said before, there's one particular event or one era of our history that is so sensitive that if you bring it up, that's what you're going to be known for. The Institute for Historical Review has been known throughout the Semitic world, which encompasses so much of our Western world today. The IHR is seen as a hateful, Holocaust-denying organization.
Right. That's right. That's what we're criticized before. And that's a reflection not of what we do or of the reality of history. What it reflects is the almost religious character that the Holocaust has come to play in our society. You touched on it earlier, but in America and in Western Europe, to demean or question or belittle or mock the Holocaust is a greater offense than mocking or belittling religion or And that you can tell the real values of a society by what it prohibits. In our society, Anne Frank has become more sacred of a character in our popular culture than the traditional figures of our religion, of Christianity, or of any religion. You can disparage and tear down the religious beliefs of the vast majority, of course, of our people and our heritage, but it's absolutely considered a blasphemy, a modern sin, to disparage or call into question this religious, new religious thing called the Holocaust, which has its own rituals, its own saints, its own high priests, and plays that kind of role in our society. It's a reflection of those who have power in our society, which is above all, of course, the organized Jewish community in America.
Now, that was a really good point you made there, Mark. I'm sure that there are some people out there who even identify themselves as Christians who would be much more upset about somebody denigrating Anne Frank as compared to the Virgin Mary. That's how much of a religious devotion people have to this Holocaust myth. So because you have come out and tried to take a factual stance on this issue to say, you know what, this stuff we're being offered as history is bunk. You have developed a whole slew of people out there who view you as the enemy, as somebody who is absolutely the epitome of evil. What kinds of actions have these groups taken against you and the IHR in the past?
Well, I think it's a badge of honor that we are continually, repeatedly, viciously attacked by organizations like the so-called Anti-Defamation League. It really ought to be called the Defamation League because that's what it engages in constantly. The Anti-Defamation League, World Jewish Congress, the SPLC, these are all essentially Jewish or quasi-hidden Jewish organizations that promote the agenda of the organized Jewish community in America, Zionist Jewish, reflections of Zionist Jewish power. Now, the most recent thing, and there's a big item about it on our website on the front page, is we are have been attacked by Dov Hykind. He's a member of the New York State Legislature. He represents a heavily Jewish district of Brooklyn in New York. He has a record as a supporter of Zionist terrorism, and he has persuaded several credit card companies to put us on their blacklist, the so-called TMF or match list, which has had the effect of cutting our ability to process credit cards. I mean, for 20 years or more, we've been processing orders and donations from people with credit cards. But Dov Hykind launched this campaign, and that resulted in this being cut off. Now, I'm fairly confident that we're going to solve this problem, and I've been working on it for the last several weeks, and I've learned an awful lot more than I ever hoped to know about the whole credit card business. But the point is, that's the sort of latest example, and Dov Hykind has put on his website an attack against us as a so-called hate organization. Now, I try very hard to avoid disparaging people because of their birth. We avoid language that is crude or hateful, but an anti-Semite in our society isn't somebody, used to be somebody that who hates Jews. Now it's somebody whom Jews hate. And Dov Hykind and the ADL attack us as a so-called hate group, when in fact we're an educational organization. We're recognized by the IRS as a public interest educational enterprise and have been for 18 years. But Dov Hykind is an ardent supporter of a regime which routinely discriminates against people on the basis of their ancestry and which routinely oppresses people on the because they're not Jewish. It's an amazing example, which is typical in our society, of the kind of arrogance, the chutzpah, that's just taken for granted in America today.
Well, all of these groups that fight against hate speech are the ones that are always just speaking such hateful things against us and causing people to take hateful actions against our organizations, which are about pride in our people. It's, It's quite something. And in your organization, which is about just trying to get down to the facts of the matter, to take a look at history beyond just the propaganda and the Hollywood approved version of history. And
right.
it's something that we need, that is just so essential. Now, there are some people out there that don't think that looking back at the past, dwelling on these subjects and trying to get the message out about how the Holocaust was largely fabricated. The numbers are pretty ridiculous. Hopefully we'll be able to get to that, about this 6 million number. But people have also been indoctrinated just about the larger struggle in general, about how World War II being the good war when the evils of Nazism were defeated. Some people say that we shouldn't really talk about these subjects so much because these will just trigger in people's minds, you know, all of the films that they've seen and just about how the Germans are so evil. So maybe we should just, you know, forget about that for now. What would be your thoughts on this subject about why it's so important that we set the record straight?
Right. I understand people take that view. They say, well, I don't really care what happened in the past. History's gone. Who cares? We're fighting for things right here and now, and we shouldn't worry about the past. Well, I understand that point of view, but it's anybody who accepts that view is going to find themselves in a corner very, very quickly, because how we view the past is really how we view the present. We don't look at the present in a vacuum. We look at the present in terms of the past. I don't mean just world history, but also in U.S. history. We have a narrative of American history that's an official one in our society, which is basically wrong. I mean, the basic narrative of American history is we're heading toward ever greater equality, ever greater inclusion, and that anybody who disagrees with that basic narrative is backward, ignorant, stupid, but so whenever we look at any current issue, it has to be looked at, and always is, well, ultimately will be looked at in terms of the past. When we consider U.S. foreign policy, people will bring up and have to bring up examples of the past. But it's like that in our individual lives as well. When we deal with people, we deal with them on the basis of our experiences with them, and what we've you trust somebody or don't trust somebody based on your pattern of behavior with that person. History is simply the record of human beings as social beings, but that's typical of many people in our America who take the view that just as they ignore history, they look at society as a collection of individuals. If we look at ourselves only as individuals and not as social beings, as members and part of something greater than ourselves, we are really impotent. We're just powerless, really, against those who do have and are fortified, armed with a sense of history. To put it more bluntly, the Jewish community in America has a deep, strong, fervent sense of itself in a historical sense, and that gives them enormous power. A historical sense gives any group of people enormously great advantage over those who think of themselves just as individuals. And I think that's an essential problem in American society today, is so many people who call themselves conservatives are really emphasizing themselves only in terms of their own rights as individuals. Well, I understand that, but it means they're going to be really incapable of taking any kind of real concerted, effective action if they only are see themselves as individuals. And the individual, a people without a sense of history and a people without a historical awareness is a people that's weak and easily controlled by others.
Well, I see that being the case for the white populations of the Western world these days. And connecting this to the lack of history, The white slavery that the European peoples went through for many centuries has been completely whitewashed. It's not that the history isn't available. It's that no one is being taught this history. Do you see this being the case in many instances?
Oh, yeah.
We know that the Holocaust
has
all these lies about it, but oftentimes, isn't it just that they're not reporting correctly? They're just omitting a lot of information that actually is out there, is verifiable, but that we just don't have any knowledge of.
Yes, the problem is not what the facts are. The problem is our perception of the past. How we look at the past isn't based on what happened so much as on what's selected. It's not that people, when they present a narrative of history, are lying so much as they're distorting. And they're distorting by picking and choosing those things which they want to emphasize. Now, a very good example of that is the recent Lincoln movie that came out, this big, spectacular Spielberg movie starring Tommy Lee Jones and other people, and so it got an Academy Award, as everybody remembers. It's accurate in a sense, but it's an enormous distortion of history. It gives a completely false idea of Lincoln's basic view. It focuses very narrowly on a period of several months when there was an effort to promote a constitutional amendment to end slavery. And it gives the impression, the false impression, that Lincoln was a man who was in favor of racial equality. Well, that's not what he believed and not what he wanted. He wanted an end to slavery. It's true. And the motion picture is accurate in that sense. But it's highly misleading, because what Lincoln did want, and this is completely left out of this big motion picture and of American history books, what he wanted was to compensate owners of slaves and then ship blacks, free blacks, from the United States outside of the country and send them to Central America or to Africa. Now, that's left out completely out of this movie. But people watching that movie more or less accept it because they think, well, it's spectacular and there's these big actors and nobody would spend so much money presenting a narrative of history if it was this inaccurate. But it is. It's highly misleading. And that's typical of how history is distorted. Not so much in what's said that's not true as in a false and distorted version of the past.
Well, yeah, after having edited this documentary I've been putting together of the recent travels we did, it just becomes so clear that it's not necessarily always about what's put in, but also about what's been left out, what's, you know, on the cutting room floor. And that gives a whole different picture of the history that's being documented. Now, what we have really as our history these days is, of course, the textbooks, and Jews are in control of the education system as well as many other systems in our world today. So it's being sent through a kosher filter, that's for sure. And then we have mainly what's shaping people's minds about historical events is Hollywood, which is almost completely Jewish controlled, and this is where people are getting their narratives. As you mentioned about the Lincoln movie by Spielberg, he was of course also the person who put together Schindler's List, which is just such an incredible example of how the great lengths they will go to just ram their narrative down our throats. And he even did it in the black and white style to make it look more like a documentary.
Right. This is all very true. And those motion pictures play a tremendous role, even subconsciously, of how Americans, including millions of Americans that consider themselves very well informed, it enormously impresses their view of the past and their sense of history. That's why you can't avoid it. A sense of history, an awareness of history, is really crucial for any kind of a sense of direction about where we're going to go in the future. It's just as an awareness of ourselves as individuals growing up is important, and what we really are is important when we make decisions about our individual lives. So also in the life of a nation or a people, the awareness of the past and the history is very, very important in knowing where to go into the future.
So let's talk about this crucial time period when the Third Reich came into power and when the alleged Holocaust took place, because I really see this as being such a defining moment or span of moments in the 20th century, which has led us to where we are today. First, I know we don't have that much time, but if you could just briefly give some examples of how the Second World War was not the great war that everybody thought it was, that the Allied powers were really fighting on, well, some would say the wrong side. I would just say a communist Jewish capitalist cabal trying to defeat one of the only powers that was standing against them. But how this has been such a crucial historical event that it seems we just have completely backwards.
Right. Well, it's a very common belief in America, particularly this notion that good guys win wars and bad guys lose wars. And it's a very, very popular view that, well, good triumphs over evil. We won World War II. The Nazis were defeated, and that's an affirmation that we're the good guys. Well, this is misleading and false for a number of reasons. First and foremost, the main power that defeated Hitler's Germany was not the United States. This is first and foremost to keep in mind. The number one power that destroyed Hitler's Germany was not the U.S., it was the Soviet Union. And in that war, the United States, the most important military ally of the U.S. in its entire history, and that is during World War II, was the Soviet Union. Now, the United States likes to portray itself as always on the side of democracy and good against evil. But in the Second World War, the greatest conflict in history, the most important military ally of the United States was the most tyrannical regime in the world at the time, the Soviet Union. Every historian, really, who goes into this subject readily acknowledges that the number of victims of Stalinist Soviet Russia outnumbers those of Hitler. But people aren't concerned about that. What they've turned World War II into is a mythologized war that emphasizes the American role in a way that's completely, quite inaccurate, very inaccurate. The second most important ally of the United States in the Second World War was Britain. Well, Britain was an empire. It was an imperial state. It was, at the time, the greatest imperialist country in the world at that time. And Britain wasn't fighting for democracy. It was a number of things, but it was fighting, above all, to preserve its empire. Now, the irony is that the United States in that Second World War is fighting not for world democracy, although the ideology of America is for a kind of egalitarianism, and that was we've seen the results of that with each passing year here in our country. But that's the first and foremost thing to remember, that the United States was not the primary force and power that won militarily in the Second World War. Four out of five German divisions were destroyed on the Eastern Front, not with the United States or with Britain. And the U.S. Invasion of Normandy, the D-Day invasion, which is memorialized in another Spielberg movie, Saving Private Ryan, that took place less than a year before the war was over, before the war ended, and after the most decisive military battles had already taken place on the Eastern Front, especially the battles of Stalingrad and Kursk, in which the Soviet Union had demonstrated its overwhelming power on the Eastern Front.
Well, we don't ever get any movies about what was happening, really, in the Soviet Union, the 60 to 66 million people that were slaughtered at the hands of these Bolsheviks, and how it was largely Jewish from its inception. We don't see movies about it, so it doesn't enter into our consciousness. All we're being fed are films showing just all the different war crimes that the Germans were committing, not any of the war crimes that were being committed against them, which all have verifiable dates and figures associated with them, not just a Hollywood movie about how Nazis are really mean. Really, the reason that people think that that was the good war primarily has nothing to do with the facts of the matter, with the situation surrounding the events that were taking place, but just with their perceptions of it that has been handed to them via the mass media. And I really do think that without the Holocaust narrative, more people would say, wait, why did we kill all those Germans again? Or why did we fund the communists to do so? Wait a second. I don't know if we were really on the right side of that one.
Right. Well, in fact, it's an amazing fact that it wasn't until the late 70s and early 80s that the Holocaust began to take on the tremendous, iconic image that it does in our society today. Standard encyclopedias did not have an entry for the Holocaust until the early 1980s. People didn't talk about the Holocaust or any of this during the World War II itself or during the 50s or during the 60s and throughout most of the 70s. The emphasis on the Holocaust, with a huge museum in Washington, D.C., run by the U.S. federal government, with a federal government agency, the United States Holocaust Memorial Council, and the obligatory, and I mean by law, obligatory emphasis on this thing called the Holocaust in American schools, didn't start until the late 70s and early 1980s, and was kicked off with another big Hollywood or television spectacular called The Holocaust that was put out on NBC. And when it came out, along with the week-long miniseries, supplements appeared in big daily newspapers all across the country, paid for by the Anti-Defamation League, to promote the film and to promote the Holocaust as this kind of new religion. You know, the head of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum said several years ago, it was reported in one of the Washington, D.C. newspapers, he said, well, there was a time when World War II was the main story and the Holocaust was a backstory. Now the Holocaust is the big event, and World War II is the backstory. It's completely distorted. The American public in World War II, if the American public during the war had been told that you're fighting to save Jews or to keep Jews, they wouldn't have fought. They were told instead another lie. They were told that the United States was fighting in order to keep from being taken over by Nazi Germany. And the American President Roosevelt and the American media engaged in an enormous campaign of distortion and lies to try to convince the American public before the United States was involved in the war that Hitler was out to control and conquer the world. It's nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. But this was what the American public was told. Now, the American public is a lot more skeptical today about what its president has to say than it was in 1941 and 1940 and 1945. In those days, the American public tended to believe much more than today that if the president said something, he was telling the truth. We're now a lot more, we've been fooled and deceived so many times that the public now is far more skeptical. But you have to remember that in 1941, when President Roosevelt solemnly told the American public that he had secret documents in his possession, which he couldn't make public, proving that Hitler was out to take over the world, the American public believed him. Now, we know that his so-called documents were fake, that these claims were not true. But the American public didn't have the same level of cynicism or skepticism that it has today. I mean, we've now been so deceived so many times by American presidents who have told us these fantastic tales. But World War II, because we won it and because it's been fortified by Hollywood, is still regarded by millions of Americans, especially conservative Americans, ironically enough, as the so-called good war, even though it was a war ultimately that meant the triumph of an ideology of egalitarianism, of universalism, that has meant, of course, the destruction of the very heritage that the vast majority of Americans took for granted and assumed that we were fighting to preserve.
Yes. So I tend to think that this cynicism, this skeptical nature of the American population, and actually populations all around the world, has led to a record number of people questioning this historical event of the Holocaust. Now, are there any facts that you can point to, any figures as to what really took place towards the end of World War II? There's absolutely no evidence of a genocidal plan, a final solution against Jews. There certainly is the final solution being put forth about how to exterminate Germans before the war, but there's no plan on record that the Germans were signing off on this. And the facts that I've seen, the Red Cross reports, it's something like 300,000 Jews might have died in camps. Do you have any kind of rough estimates as to how many Jews suffered at the hands of the Germans in that war, and also what the causes were? It seems a lot of them were dying of typhus, that their deaths were malnutrition caused by the bombing, the Allied bombing of German supply lines, and everybody was starving. What actually happened from what you're able to gather during this time period?
Well, the question, there's so many angles to go at that question, but I'll take a stab at some points here. At the end of the war, American troops liberated the Dachau, and British troops, Buchenwald Camp, Dora, and so forth, Bergen-Belsen, and found many dead and or dying and starving and diseased inmates. These images, of course, were terrible, were awful. There were many dead people already at Bergen-Belsen, Dachau, which I've visited several of the campsites myself. Anyway, these images were shocking to the American public, and the American public was told this is part of a diabolical German plan to exterminate lots of people. Well, these images are very, very misleading. Bergen-Belsen was a terribly overcrowded camp with all sorts of dead and dying people, not as a result of a German policy, but as a result, as you indicated earlier, of the chaos of the final weeks of the war. Now, this is known, really, to people who are serious students of the subject, but that story is just not known to the general public. We're told a very different narrative. Probably the most famous individual of the Holocaust, the so-called most famous Holocaust victim, is probably Anne Frank. Well, very few people realize that Anne Frank wasn't killed in a gas chamber. She wasn't killed. She died of typhus several weeks before the end of the war, along with her sister in the Bergen-Belsen camp. And one of the main points is if the plan or policy had been to kill Anne Frank, she would have been killed long before she was found by British soldiers who liberated the Bergen-Belsen camp near the end of the war. Now, I don't want to play down the fact there was an enormous policy of repression and of killing of many Jews during World War II. But again, the important point is not that what happened plays the role in our how we view the past. What's important is what we emphasize. We don't emphasize the fact that the American policy during World War II was to kill every German that the United States could in these bombings. The target was everybody, but we don't emphasize that. We emphasize instead a German policy, a selective one, against Jews. When Jews were rounded up, they were set off to the east, they were put in camps, many died. But that emphasis is a reflection of who has power in our society. And again, mentioned earlier, there's no emphasis in our media and so forth on the U.S. alliance with the Soviet Union in World War II, which was responsible for far more deaths than Germany. Now, the point is, it's not what is it that America was fighting for in World War II? The American President Roosevelt said at the time was a new world order. It was going to be ruled permanently by the United States in alliance with the Soviet Union and Britain. Now, it broke down because of the competition and differences between the United States and the Soviet Union, but that was the plan. Now, that was a utopian and crazy plan, but that's what America officially was supposedly fighting for in World War II. So those people that are worried about globalism and universalism in our society should realize and understand that that was the proclaimed goal of the United States during World War II, a universal world order in which distinctions of race, culture, religion, and so forth would be essentially, ultimately obliterated in favor of a universalist, egalitarian world order that was going to be presided over by the United States and the Soviet Union together. Now, that's very, very different than what the Axis were fighting for. But what played a crucial role in building up American support for the war, even starting in the 1930s, was this tremendous propaganda already in place in the American media, above all by Jewish-controlled Hollywood and film, motion pictures, newsreels, and the media, and the press, and newspapers and magazines at that time. But Americans don't understand that because we have very little antidote to that in our media today.
Well, it's amazing how they lie to get us into these wars, and then they lie in retrospect about the reasons we ever were in the wars to begin with. They're always changing their stories. It's quite incredible, and they'll fabricate evidence afterwards to make sure that their story at least seems somewhat plausible, such as the case with the gas chambers that the Soviets created. How fortuitous that all of the alleged death camps fell into Soviet hands, and then they were able to construct chimneys that weren't even connected to buildings. The most ludicrous of stories about what actually happened there. And you talked about Anne Frank. It appears that part of her diary was written in a ballpoint pen, and those weren't even invented at the time that she was supposed to be writing the diary. So I don't know if that's necessarily true, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, one thing I wanted to say about how we rewrite or distort the past. Just a few weeks ago, members, high-ranking officials of both the Democratic and Republican Party, Boehner, Harry Reid, John Kerry, all were at a ceremony in the Capitol to unveil a bust to Winston Churchill. Now, Winston Churchill, amazingly, is more popular in the United States than he is even in Britain. There's a lot of reasons for that, but he's a kind of hero because Republicans and Democrats cannot agree on who's a heroic person in the 20th century, except Winston Churchill, who above all is characterized by his opposition to Hitler. He was the Prime Minister of Britain during World War II. Now, by today's standards, Winston Churchill was, by the normal standards of the United States today, a hopeless racist, hopelessly politically incorrect. He had ordered the use of chemical weapons and poison gas when he was Secretary of War earlier on. He was in favor of keeping British control over India and of doing whatever is necessary to suppress people there. But he's considered a good guy because he was against Hitler. Now, one of the amazing, remarkable things is that in the speech praising Winston Churchill, John Kerry mentioned that Winston Churchill had, a year after the war, or 2 years after the war, had talked about the danger of the Soviet Union and that an Iron Curtain had come down over Europe. He made a big point of that because Winston Churchill did publicize this term Iron Curtain. But what they leave out is that during the war, Winston Churchill was an ardent, fervent ally of the Soviet Union. It's only after the war that he decides, well, maybe we made a big mistake here, and talked about this. And an additional irony is that the phrase Iron Curtain, used by Churchill after the war to talk about how the Soviets had taken over and had sealed off their part of Europe that they controlled, this term was actually used by the Germans as the war was going on, saying this is what's going to happen if we lose the war. You're going to have American – Goebbels wrote an article in February 1945, just several months before the end of the war, entitled To the Year 2000. And he predicted if we lose this war, the Soviets and the Americans will occupy this continent, and American troops will still be in Europe in the year 2000. Well, they're still there in the year 2013. My point is that they're praising Churchill for his so-called wisdom when by ignoring entirely the fact that during the war, Churchill and the United States were strong, fervent, and trusting allies of the Soviet Union.
Well, what's so incredible to me is that it's always put forth that the Jews were the big losers of World War II. There was the Shoah, the Holocaust that happened. They were just treated so poorly. And still, even afterwards, the anti-Semites in America and Europe just made them feel so unwelcome. When you look at the actual situation, what's going on around us today, what's happened since then, all you see is more and more Jews taking progressive control of these nations. And you can say that they're Jewish communists, as many of them were over the years. But Jews won that war, and they won control of all of the different lands. It wasn't necessarily a clean conquest, but they sure have gotten themselves into all the different positions of power. And now, by using their false narrative of the past, They have tried to set themselves up as being beyond any kind of question, that you can't even wonder why we have dual citizens from only one nation. America is only allowed to have dual citizens from just one nation, and that's the nation of Israel, acting at the highest levels of the United States government. And you say anything about it, you're an anti-Semite, you're, a Holocaust denier? Boy, you know, it's incredible what they've been, the power they've been able to wield since the Axis fell in World War II.
Just a few weeks ago, the Vice President Biden made a speech to some Jewish leaders in which he said bluntly, and of course in a flattering way to them, that the great social changes of the last recent years have been largely because of Jews, that overwhelmingly it's been Jewish influence and control and power in the media that's been responsible for what's happening in American history. He said the Jewish role in our cultural and political life has been more important than that of any other group in the past century of the United States. He said he talked about what he called the immense and outsized power of Jews here in the United States. And he said, that's just wonderful. That's just all great. Now, there seems to be no limit to the power that a group that makes up no more than 2% of the population can have in our society. It's unbelievable. Now, I would, no matter what you think about how much power Jews have or shouldn't have or so forth, to allow any group that makes up a tiny minority to have that kind of outsized power is dangerous in any society. I wouldn't like it if Methodists had that much power, or
Buddhists,
any particular
even.
Group had that, or any particular group to have that much power. But we're supposed to accept that there's no limit to how much power and influence Jews have. In fact, the Anti-Defamation League has a guide or a test to anti-Semitism. And one of the questions they ask people is, if you do Jews have too much power? If you agree with the statement that Jews have too much power in our society, that marks you as an anti-Semite. Well, apparently, there's no limit to how much power this group can have. Every other group, you can say, well, they have too much power. If you say white males have too much power, or corporations have too much power, or Catholics have too much power, people will say, well, that's your opinion, or I agree, or I don't agree. But they don't say you're a hater or you're a bad person for having that view. But in the case of Jews, you're supposed to accept no matter what happens. So we have a situation here in California. Both senators, 100% of the senators of California are Jewish. There are no Protestant males anymore on the United States Supreme Court, but there are three or four Jews. The mayors of America's three largest cities are Jews. The head of the Federal Reserve is Jewish. And, of course, they have this immense grip on our mass media. Now, you're not supposed to even acknowledge or even mention that this is a fact, except if you're doing it in a way to praise this power. Biden can get away with it because he thinks it's wonderful. But anybody who mentions this enormous power, far greater than that of any other single ethnic religious group in the United States is called a hater merely for acknowledging or pointing out this tremendous power. And, of course, for mentioning the immense consequences, and I think harmful consequences, this has for our nation and the world.
Yes, it is really quite evident that it's not the WASP elite that is running our nations. Even though all of the media is going to try to lead you in that direction, that it's WASPs who are in power. No, I think it's pretty obvious nowadays.
It's unbelievably crazy to imply that American foreign policy is determined by WASPs or corporations. WASPs are big corporations. Want America to stay out of these crazy Middle Eastern wars. You cannot understand American policy in the world, and especially in the Middle East, without understanding the immense power, as Biden says, that the Jewish community has in our society. Otherwise, U.S. policy makes no sense. There's no other way to explain how it is, time and again, that the United States and Israel are on one side and the entire rest of the world is on the other side on issue after issue. How does one explain it? Well, the only rational, reasonable explanation is because of the tremendous power that the Jewish community has here in the United States.
So let's talk about one of the things that they are doing to destroy the nations that fought so hard for egalitarianism, for democracy, the Western world, the European peoples. What they are doing, and Jews say that they are at the center of this change, as Barbara Spector has noted before, they are flooding each and every white country with endless immigration. The wars in the Middle East, they serve many different purposes, one of which, I believe, is to just displace all of these people and then to put them into a white European homeland, such as Sweden or Norway or Denmark, or to Australia, to the United States, wherever it is, where white people once had the ability to live safe, happy lives. It's now just become a complete multicultural mess. And this seems to be one of the biggest weapons they have going. What do you think about what's been taking place in this regard?
Well, you've hit on a very important point. Organizations like the Anti-Defamation League, the World Jewish Congress, the American Jewish Committee, these organizations are constantly telling Americans that they have to embrace ever more diversity and pluralism, that tolerance and diversity are good and important. In fact, Bill Clinton, several years ago, in one of his major speeches, State of the Union speech, said that diversity, he says, is our greatest strength. Now, the ADL took some pride in the fact that they had developed this slogan and were pleased that President Clinton had used it in one of his major addresses. Now, this isn't merely untrue. This isn't merely not a falsehood. It's a lie. And what I mean by a lie, it's a conscious falsehood. It's a conscious falsehood because the very organizations that promote this promote it only for people other than themselves. They promote diversity and pluralism for non-Jewish societies, but in Israel, they promote exactly the opposite slogan and ideology. They insist that Israel must stay a Jewish ethnic religious state, that Israel's identity as a Jewish state is essential, is important. But they don't grant that right to any other people. Everyone else is expected to, and it's demand. They insist that everybody else embrace pluralism, diversity, tolerance, except in one country. Now, it's as if to say there's one standard for the Gentiles, one standard for the Goyim, and another standard for Jews. And that underscores the hypocrisy, the two-faced nature of this campaign that's been going on for many, many years.
Yes, they're always saying, do as I say, not as I do. Mark, there's so many other places we could go for tonight, but there are a few callers on the board. Do you have just a few minutes
and we can try to field some
of these calls?
I hope so, yes. I have to in about...
Okay, yeah, we'll make this as quick as possible. Caller from the 818 area code, who is this and what question do you have for Mark? Please make it quick.
Hi, my name is Steven. I actually just wanted his thoughts on this character who used to be associated with the IHR was a Jewish revisionist, David Cole. He was recently outed from his new identity, and I guess during this time he was a Holocaust historian, and he also wrote some disparaging remarks with his new identity against the IHR. So I was just curious about his thoughts.
All right. Thanks for the question, Stephen. I'm going to put you back on mute here, and we'll let Mark talk about David Cole, who later became David Stein, and I guess produce some
right.
Holocaust documentaries for some money.
Right. Right. Well, we sell a video that he did about a visit to Auschwitz, and it's interesting. He was threatened by the Jewish Defense League. His life was threatened. He was beaten up by a Jewish Defense League activists. And then he changed his – he went underground. He changed his name to David Stein. Then he outed himself, or he was outed recently in an article in The Guardian. And he said, well, he's still sort of a revisionist. Now, I mean, we don't take responsibility for the views of any particular person who either speaks at one of our meetings or conferences or who has written for the journal. The IHR has presented – over the years, the views and outlook of many, many different people, some of them Jewish, like David Cole. I haven't seen David Cole in many, many years. He's responsible for his own actions, but it's a kind of an interesting story. But basically, he was shut up because of the tremendous pressure and threats and beatings by this organization, the Jewish Defense League, which the FBI calls a terrorist organization, and which this Jewish politician in New York, Dov Hikin, was a member, an activist of.
Wow,
it's a
I didn't
terrorist
know that.
Organization, and it's attacked the IHR.
Well, I definitely appreciated the work that David Cole did at the time. It's a shame that he was abused in such a way, and that he, then turned to making Holocaust movies. But let's go on and take a few more of these calls here if we can get them in time. I think this is Jim. Jim, what's your question for Mark?
Yes, Mark. I would like to ask you what the difference was between Hitler's new order in Europe and the new world order of the Jews that was promulgated by the Americans and the British. And I have another question. Do you think that Hitler was justified in attacking the Soviet Union in June 22nd, 1941, Operation Barbarossa? And,
all right, thanks for the question, Jim.
I want to thank you very much. You're a great Aryan warrior, and I want to salute you for the courageous stand that you're taking, getting the truth to the people. Thank you.
Thanks for the question, Jim.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, the first question, there's an audio podcast by me and an essay by me entitled How Hitler Tackled Unemployment and Revive Germany's Economy, which I recommend strongly. It lays out that the essence of his economic program was to do what was best for the German people, not for corporations and not for world financial interests. And that meant, during the 1930s, separating the German economy from the, at that time, essentially British-controlled financial system and building up the German economy so that during the 1930s, Germany was the one industrial country that actually tackled the unemployment problem and ended the Great Depression, which was affecting the rest of the world. With regard to the Soviet Union, I've done a number of broadcasts on that. In fact, on YouTube, there's a video made of a podcast I did entitled "Why Hitler Attacked Soviet Russia in 1941." It's gotten some 20,000 hits, and you'll hear me talking about and answering that question in great detail. The short answer is that Hitler attacked the Soviet Union because he had good reason for believing, as historians, I think, largely acknowledge, although not publicly and not in a way that Americans know, that Stalin himself was preparing to attack Germany and the rest of Europe. And there's far more openness about this aspect of history by Russian historians today than there is in the United States. and even more in Britain than there is in the United States. But this is these are very important questions. They deserve a lot longer answers than I can give in just a few minutes here.
Mark, we really appreciate your time here so much. And as for what you said about the economic recovery, I really think that this is one of the reasons that the Holocaust is promoted so much in regard to World War II, because it really obscures the real history of what happened prior to the war even breaking out, which is that Hitler was able to get his country flourishing again. The NSDAP was doing amazing things before the world powers were unleashed against them. Mark, do you have time for just one more question here?
Well, okay, just one more, I hope, yes.
One more. There actually are three more people looking to ask you questions, but if we have time for one more, that would be great. And, Mark, hopefully we'll be able to have you back again sometime, because it seems like people just really want to hear what you have to say.
Well, I'd be very happy to be back with you again sometime.
Great. Thanks. Caller, hello, who is this? And quickly ask your question, please.
Hi, Kyle. Hi, Mr. Weber. My name's Frank. And I just wanted to say I saw a YouTube video of you, Mr. Weber, debating Michael Shermer from the so-called Skeptic magazine, and you basically buried him with evidence. All he had were a few vague quotations from Nazi leaders, and I got the impression watching the interview that he knew you were right. And he just knew deep inside that if he came out and admitted it, if he came out and said, oh, you got me on this one, you won the debate, his magazine would be done. He would be done. Do you often find, so my question is this, do you often find yourself in the ridiculous position of having to debate people who know you're right?
Well, thank you very much. I think it's hard enough to figure out our own motives and what makes ourselves tick, and it's hard, even harder to try to understand what's going on inside the mind of somebody else. But during that debate, I mean, we sell videos of that on our website. You can find it. Shermer even admitted during the debate that the so-called gas chamber they were showing to the public at this Majdanek camp is a fake. It's a fraud. I was astonished at this admission he made during the course of the debate. I don't know if it's often the case, but over and over, some of these points that we're making are so obvious, and I've been very pleased that over the last 10, 15 years, there's at least a lot more realization and acknowledgement than there was when I began all of this, when I began working at this, that our media is largely controlled by one particular group, and that we have a distorted view of the present and of the past. That's now very widely acknowledged in a way that didn't used to be the case, and so there a lot of progress has been made in that regard.
Great.
Well, thanks for the call, Frank.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, Mark, I really appreciate you coming on and doing this show tonight. I know the audience did as well. So we will have to get you back soon and continue this conversation. But for tonight, that is it, everyone. Folks, thank you for tuning in. And, Mark, again, thank you so much for taking the time out to have this conversation here with me tonight.
Thank you for having me on. I'd be glad to be back. Very stimulating. Good questions and good comments and questions by you. Thank you.
Much appreciated. We're going to go out with a little bit of music.
The sun on the meadow is summer even. The stag in the forest runs free. But gather together to greet the storm. Tomorrow belongs to me. The branch of the linden is leafy and green. The Rhine gives its gold to the sea. But somewhere a glory of it unseen tomorrow belongs to me. Eyes, the blossom embraces the bee. Oh,